You ready? I'm going to open the House Committee on Human Services on today, April 24th, 2009. Colleagues, you should have gotten an email earlier, either I think yesterday.
Yeah.
6:14 p.m. I'm sorry. But anyway, we are carrying over House Bill 2726, 2990, 2207. Is this enough time? They're on your list there. You don't need to write them down, right? 3384, 2134, and 3065.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
What was the 65? Was that 3065?
You should have that. Yes, okay. 3065. And you should have that.
There it is.
Okay, Representative Hannah, you're first on. So we will open up a public hearing.
I think that's the only one I'm
on. 3384. Do you have any questions?
2609.
I'm sorry, 2609. Did you have a question?
Okay, we were just checking records here.
Okay, open up a public hearing, first public hearing on House Bill 2609. Keeley?
This bill requires the Department of Human Services and the Department of Revenue to establish and maintain an outreach program to educate senior citizens and persons with disabilities about the possibility of deferring property taxes on homesteads.
Representative Hannah, welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Made our meeting.
Thank you for having me here. Members of the committee, good morning. For the record, Bruce Hannah, State Representative, House District 7. I'm here this morning to provide a short history of Oregon Project Independence and a bit of the intent of House Bill 2609. Some quick points you should know. Oregon's senior population growth is among the very highest in the nation. The number of Oregonians age 65 and older is expected to increase from about 13% of the population to 21% of the population by the year 2020. Some of you are there, and some will be in that group. For over 24 years, Oregon Project Independence has been the cornerstone of the Seniors and People with Disabilities Program in DHS. Over 60% of OPI clients earn less than 100% of the federal poverty level. I want to say that one again. 60% of the OPI clients earn less than 100% of the federal poverty level. OPI provides approximately $170 to $2,300 per month per person in cost avoidance to the state as compared to adult foster care, assisted living, and nursing facilities. That is a key point about this program. It is a cost avoidance to the state to a huge degree. In 2005, the legislature passed Senate Bill 870, which allows excess funds in the senior property tax deferral revolving account to be transferred into the OPI fund beginning in the 2007-09 biennium. Excess in the account is defined as the greater of 35% of the prior tax year payments to counties, or $5 million. Senate Bill 870 also removed the obligation of the Department of Revenue to repay to the general fund the amounts advanced to the senior property tax deferral revolving account within the department from the general fund as of July 1, 2007. As you may know or may not know, Oregon Project Independence Fund is projected to go into a deficit position in 2010. The purpose of House Bill 2069 is to address the funding shortfall, in part by adjusting the current requirements for participation in the senior property tax deferral program. The adjustments include adds the definition of federal adjusted gross income, raises the annual income limit from $39,000 to $49,000, and indexes the amount to the Portland CPI, requires DHS and the Department of Revenue to establish and maintain an outreach program to educate seniors and persons with disability about the opportunity to defer property taxes, and finally provides $4 million out of the general fund to the senior property tax deferral revolving account. By enabling more seniors to participate in the property tax deferral program, we can build a funding source for future needs. I do recognize there will be an impact on the state's revenue, but I also believe there will be an offsetting savings in health care spending. With the additional $4 million to the account, we could stabilize the program while DHS and the Department of Revenue implement their outreach program. Again, I appreciate being able to visit with you this morning and would hope you would consider passing this bill.
Thank you so much, Representative. We're happy to see you here today. Thank you for coming and presenting this bill. Any questions, Representative Hanna?
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Representative Hanna, if there is a deferral, that means they're not paying taxes for that year, and if the property sells, then there's that lien on the property so that eventually it will be repaid. Is that correct?
Yes.
Second question. If the follow-up, Madam Chair, sorry.
Thank you.
If the property is deferred, does that remove its value from the value rolls of the property tax?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions of Representative Hanna? Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hanna, thank you for bringing this forward. Do you see the $4 million that would come from the general fund as being adequate to keep OPI intact over the next biennium? What kind of projections are you basing it on? Obviously, this is something that's very important.
I believe the $4 million is somewhat of a bridge. It fills the gap. Obviously, likely more would be better in this case. However, by giving them by filling the gap and providing that bridge funding, it keeps the program viable.
Mm-hmm. And follow-up?
Follow-up.
And presumably, part of the reason that the program is hurting is because of the challenges in property values now. Is that correct? Or, you know, is your hope that it, in the future, as more people know about the program, it will increase its viability and as property values rise?
I'm not sure that the decrease in property value is necessarily the loss of funding. I think the outreach program that DHS would develop so that you could encourage more people to participate will certainly help energize the program.
Thank you.
Further questions? All right. Thank you so
much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
John Phillips.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. Thank you for inviting me to talk today a little bit about the Senior Deferral Program. I'm here to answer any questions you might have, but also maybe just to give you a little more background than the representative provided. I also have some handouts that might be beneficial to you. Excuse me. The Senior Deferral Program started in 1964, and it was the first such program in the nation. So we've been a leader in that, and to the credit of the legislature for thinking and designing a program that helps seniors stay in their homes is really a laudable policy objective. Oregon is now one of 24 states that have a similar program such as this. Initially, the program, as mentioned earlier, was funded through seed money from the legislature. A total over the years, beginning with early in the program, until about 1995, the legislature contributed about $55 million over that period as seed money. It was at that point in the program where the repayments started to come into the program more than the taxes paid out, and the program became self-funding at that point. Subsequent to that, the legislature requested reversions from that account as it grew. And there were reversions to the general fund in the amount of $78 million through the year of 2004-2005.
Is that in your materials here, John?
It is not in the materials.
Could you repeat that then, please?
I will repeat that. The payments, the program became self-funding after the 94-95 tax year. To that point, the legislature had appropriated up to $55 million. The subsequent year, the revolving account for senior deferral reverted $5 million. The subsequent year, another five. In 2000, 2001, $17 million. In 2002, three, $24 million. And I can provide this to you. I'm sorry.
That would be great.
And finally, $27.7 million in the 05-06 tax year.
So how much total?
$78 million. The law required that the funds be repaid with interest. And I don't believe that the entire amount with interest was repaid at that point, but that is when 870 passed and provided for funding to go to the Oregon Project Independence. And there was provisions in that bill that eliminated future repayments. That was the 05 session, as I recall. Since then, based on that Senate Bill 870, in 2005, $250,000 was paid to the Oregon Project Independence. And that was in 2006, January 2006, and then another $14.3 million in 2007-08. Annually, our research unit projects what the fund balance will be. We're projecting the fund balance would be in the negative in November of 2010. And the way the fund works is that every year in November, taxes for all the participants are paid to the respective counties where the property exists. So that's the big outgo from the fund. Then every month, as people, for whatever reason, whether they leave the program for either they pass on or they refinance or they sell the property or they otherwise become disqualified, then the lien effectually creates a repayment. And the repayments are in excess of about $1 million a month, and the taxes are about $15 million a year right now, $16 million. So there's just a little more coming in than going out. But there's been a change in the last couple of years because of the economy, we believe, and because of the payments going to OPI, depleted the fund. There were some thresholds in there to provide for it not to be depleted, but in fact we had an economy that was doing things that no one expected. So right now our payments to counties for the taxes are up slightly, the repayments are down significantly, and our forecast is that in 2010, when we would normally make the payment in November, we'll be down $300,000. 1 year later, in November of 2011, it's projected to be down, I think, $1.2 million, and then down from there. So I've raised this issue with your legislative revenue officer, Paul Warner, and with the chair of the House Revenue Committee in January, I believe, and we've been having discussions about that since then. So this particular bill and what I've provided you shows what we have been doing in terms of outreach, a very important factor, and important to let seniors know what's available to them. We don't have a regular plan to go out into counties or places to talk to folks, but we have, like, for example, in 2007, you'll see in the handout, we did make an effort without statutory responsibility. We just thought this would be a good thing to do. We contacted Nicole Palmateer. We got a hold of senior leaders in various communities throughout the state. We held 18 sessions statewide. We had very low participation. A lot of excitement to come, but then there wasn't a lot of participation. So I'm not really sure whether that's a function of our advertising campaign or lack of interest or need. Not really sure. We didn't do an analysis, but that was the result. There is about 7,850 participants in the senior deferral program right now. And what else can I tell you?
Yes. Representative, thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. Several questions. First one is, when these roadshows, the Ways and Means roadshows, go out, not because we haven't, they just started, but last session, one of the concerns was in the disability community that these folks don't show up because they're at night, the meetings are at night, they don't have transportation. And so maybe a function of them not showing up is they, you know, maybe the timing of the meetings, I don't know. Probably, I'm assuming yours are during the day, that they don't have transportation, they're cut off from access. So I don't know if people showing up is really a function of, I mean, there's other factors that are somewhat outside of control. Madam Chair, follow-up. The question is, what other deferral programs do we have in the state besides the senior and disabled? I know one off the top of my head, and it's veterans. Veterans widow deferral program. Because my mom participates in that.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, are you referring to, if I might ask, are you referring to the partial exemption for war veterans, spouses?
Quite frankly, I don't know.
Okay.
All I know is my mom gets a deferral on her property taxes because she's the widow of a veteran.
Madam Chair, if I might attempt a response, my mother-in-law receives a partial exemption from that program also. And the way that works is that it is not a deferral. It is, if I'm understanding it correctly, I'm not aware of a property tax deferral for veterans or surviving spouses of veterans. I am aware of a partial exemption, which says essentially a certain amount of money, and I don't recall the annual amount, it's indexed, but let's just say $8,000 of assessed value comes off the bottom of your assessed value each year, and that's indexed. And there's two tiers, one for service-connected disabilities and one for non-service-connected disabilities.
Okay. Well, you don't have to go into that.
Okay.
So, but that's based on the assessed value of the house?
Yes.
Okay. Which is a different approach than what we take under this program.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, yes. I am aware, to answer your initial question, of two other programs for deferral mentioned in the materials, and that is the deferral for disabled individuals, which has been folded into this program. I don't recall the year that it came into effect, but it's not been around as long as the senior deferral. And then there's a program called the Special Assessment Deferral, and you might be familiar with a situation where a city or a county might put in a road improvement and assess $10,000 per property, let's say, based on a square footage, and it's just too much to pay all at once, and particularly for a senior. And so the city will provide for an opportunity to go into a deferral program where the state then pays that annual payment. And there are 42 participants in that program today. And we think there's a reason for that. And we're not here to discuss that probably, but there are drawbacks to that program because interest accrues on the remaining part, not in deferral, to some very prohibitive ways for seniors.
Right. Colleagues, this is an issue I would like us to revisit at a later time. We have a lot on our plate today. So, John, I'd like you to come back and we'll hear more about both of the issues that were brought up here today. Could you put that on our tickler file for later? Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. Is there anyone else here who wished to speak on that? Did you wish anything more, Representative Hanna? Thank you for bringing this to us, and we will be looking into this further. Thank you very much. I will close the public hearing on 2609. Okay. So, let's see, we've done that. And so now we're going to open up a work session on 2205.
House Bill 2205 gives the Child Care Division of the Oregon Employment Department authority to impose a civil penalty of up to $500 on facilities licensed as certified child care that violate statutes governing certified child care facilities and allocates penalty monies to the Child Care Fund. The recommended -2 amendment establishes minimum requirements for assessing those penalties and establishes a quarterly maximum.
Colleagues, I think we first heard this in February. I hope that we're going to be able to have a different system next legislative session. It is so difficult to hear things in February and then not be able to work it until April. It just puts us at a great disadvantage.
I agree. Constitutional majority on that one. Our memories aren't that good.
No, our memories aren't that good. We hear a lot of compelling testimony, and then in the ensuing months, we've heard a lot of testimony in other bills, and I tend to mush it all together. So do we have anyone who wishes to speak on this?
They're shaking their heads that they don't need to speak. I don't know. Representative Huffman worked on the amendment, so he may have something that he wants to say.
Madam Chair, we have spent... this may be one of those bills that almost required February through April to for all parties to, you know, I think really feel like everything was fleshed out. And I think there is fairly widespread agreement to the approach. At least that's my understanding from participants in the initial work group and ensuing groups that also included the providers union representatives. And I'm more comfortable with the approach that we're using than the original bill, because it allows for, I don't know if flexibility is the right word, but it the approach is that the department would work with providers initially to come up with solutions rather than just hit them with a fine up front and some of those approaches. And so I'm much more comfortable with it.
Good.
And I appreciate the department, everybody working with us.
Terrific, and I appreciate you working together with everybody to come up with a good solution. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Cowan looks perplexed.
I wondered if we could just get a brief overview of what the amendments are.
Yes, could you give us that, Representative Huffman?
Will do.
Walk us through the amendments.
See if I can find
it.
The one
copy, Representative.
I have a copy. Maybe this is something I've already heard. I'm just trying to get my brain around what this is
the
telling
me. The dash two, right? Yes,
ma'am.
Just walk us briefly through
it. Is it dash two?
Kind of.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a dash two?
No.
Here.
Kind of where this started. This is, of course, we're dealing with the child care division of the Employment Department. And we had been approached registered daycare providers, and if I get some of the terms mixed up, forgive me, but registered daycare providers, and they could implement a fine up to $100 for infractions. But there was no provision to work with certified daycare providers, which can handle a much greater number of children. And so they came before us wanting to be able to implement up to a $500 fine. And that's when I began the discussion about, well, is it going to be up to 500 or will it be 500? And so they worked with us to come up with a matrix that would allow for a warning and then implementing of a fine. And through that bracket, you don't just jump 500 all at once necessarily. There's a way of getting there, and it's a method of working with the providers to correct a problem rather than just impose a fine right up front. Is Representative Cowan, is that a
it does answer
kind of bring
my
back
question.
Some
Thank you.
Memories of it?
I just seem to be missing one of the amendments, and that might be why I had that confused look on my face. I'll get that straightened out. Sorry.
Great. Any other questions? All right. Representative, let me make a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2205, dated April
9th, 2009. Representative Huffman moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2205, dated April 9th, 2009. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2205 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Huffman moves House Bill 2205 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Zach, will you call the roll, please? I'm sorry. Suzanne, go ahead.
Well, I thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say, having been on the other side of this event, of this circumstance, I do hope that it is not a capricious experience for programs, because sometimes it isn't with the best intent.
having said that.
Okay. It's on the public record.
Thank you.
Representative Van Orman. Great. Any other questions?
Well, yes. That might be a good time. Thank you,
sure.
Madam Chair. During our time, and I was on Rep. Huffman's
sorry, I didn't
too.
Acknowledge you.
That's
thank
all
you
right.
For working
it's
on
all right,
that.
Because I kind of spun off on my own tack, and Tom helped me understand what was going on, and this is the issue of the unregistered, unoversighted other preschools. And I did what you said.
Good.
It's my priority. I have a bill. In the subsequent time between getting it drafted and just this morning, I've received information that not only when it started out, nobody seemed to know how many of these schools existed, and now we have numbers, so we're working on it. And it was my thought that if we don't do something, knowing that there's this situation that exists, that we leave ourselves open to liability if any of these children are damaged and we didn't do anything. And I understand the need to study it further and bring people together, and there may not be time, the time with it between now and Monday or Tuesday, to do everything that we might want to do. But if we start the process, I think that we've done what we can do this far.
And I promise you, in this committee, we will start that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for working on that. Any further questions or comments? Okay. Zach, you want to call the roll, please?
Representative Van Orman.
Aye.
Representative Mallett.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
No.
I'll be here.
Representative Dimbro.
Aye.
Representative Callan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Holden.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having received the required majority, House Bill 2205, as amended, passes, and we'll go on to the floor with the new pass recommendation. Representative Huffman, do you want to carry that?
Certainly, Madam
Great.
Chair.
I will close the work session on House Bill 2205. Okay, so we will open up a work session on House Bill 2988.
House Bill 2988 directs the Child Care Division of the Employment Department to establish the Voluntary Central Background Registry and conduct criminal records checks and child protective services checks for applicants who are employees or volunteers providing child care services. The recommended committee amendment, which is also the dash 2, allows for enrollment in the registry on completion of a criminal records check, eliminates the requirement of a child protective services check and enrollment in the criminal history registry, and allows for enrollment of individuals who are determined to have no criminal history, but removes the ability to enroll if individuals who have dealt with their problems or provided adequate evidence of suitability, it removes their ability to be a part of the registry.
Great. We have somebody from the department give us a little summary of this.
That's what I remember.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Olson, administrator of the Oregon Child Care Division. And this bill, I'm just going to give you a little bit of background because this bill originated with the Child Care Commission, and Heidi McGowan is here to speak to that. But in terms of background as to how this began in the first place, I'm a member of a work group that works with the Commission on Children and Families, looking at the early childhood system in Oregon globally. And I think about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, I was... when the commissions did their planning process, the county commissions, a number of the commissions identified as a significant barrier the fact that child care providers, volunteers, other folks that work in early childhood must often complete two or three separate background checks depending on the area that they choose to work in. A Head Start volunteer would have to have a background check. Someone who volunteers in a school might have to have a separate one. If they want to be a child care provider, that's yet another one. We heard from folks that sometimes had to go through four checks. And so it was a problem for them. And so the commission asked me to chair a committee to see if there could be an answer to this situation. What they were looking at originally was whether or not there could be one single background check process for everybody in the state. And so we tried to bring everybody together, the state police, DHS, Department of Education, all the folks that you could think of that might be interested. And it quickly became apparent that there is not one set of rules that each agency was willing to follow, because each agency has a different criteria for fitness determinations, meaning that they have different rules about who can work in their program and who cannot. And so about the time we were thinking that this was not going to go anywhere, we thought, well, how about if we create a registry of folks that have no criminal history at all in their background? Those folks would then be good to go in terms of working with other programs in the state. And it seemed to be a fairly cost-effective way to go about it. It answered most of the commission's questions. In looking at our own database of child care providers, and we have about 40,000 on our criminal history registry, approximately 80 to 85% of them would qualify to be in the criminal history registry by virtue of the fact that they're folks that have just never had any criminal history in their background. And the main thing here is that if there is criminal history of any kind beyond, for instance, a traffic violation, you're not going to qualify. There are just too many things we can't do. We haven't got the time or the expertise, or we've got the expertise, but not the time or the money to do fitness determinations on folks that might have some sketchy history or some history somewhere. So those folks are off the table. It has to be folks with no criminal history. And we're doing this, basically the Child Care Division has agreed to do this at no additional cost to the state. So it's we hope to be providing a service that will allow folks to work to avoid a lot of bureaucracy that is in place right now, and with, of course, keeping our eye on the major mission, which is keeping kids as safe as we possibly can.
Great. Thank you so much. Any questions? Anyone in this?
I have a few questions. Yeah, thank you. Tom, appreciate you giving us again the history of that and a review of it. A couple questions that I have. One, okay, I get the idea that the person doesn't have any criminal history that plugs into this. And you said 80%?
That's approximately, with our population, that's right, yes.
Okay, follow up. Mm-hmm. How are you going to maintain the security for this database? It seems to me like we've had this discussion, but I'm trying to kind of go back and remember how you're attempting to do that.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, it'll be part of our existing criminal history registry, and we've operated that now for 6 years, I suppose. And we have many, many different controls in place. Our people are all LED certified that run this background, that run the background checks. We have all the certifications and all the basically the elements in place that we can to maintain security of this. Any database, anytime you have folks on database, it's always a concern. And it's just really depends on how well you manage that database. And I think anyone that knows us knows that we do this as well as anyone.
And then a follow-up again, uh-huh. Now that you mentioned LEDs, because that was a follow-up too, I wanted to... So everyone who accesses is certified through LEDS. Is there a connection then with LEDS, with this database?
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, I'm going to ask Kathleen to come up and give you more technical data. She's our legal and compliance manager, and I can probably give you basic information, but I think you're going places that she needs to talk
about. Chair Tomei, excuse me. Representative Olson, my name is Kathleen Hines. I'm the Legal and Compliance Manager with the Child Care Division. In answer to your question, anyone who would like to apply to be in this voluntary background registry would fill out an application, and it would be a fingerprint identification background check, which is using the LEDS law enforcement data system information to do that. If the person passes that background check, if there's no criminal history, they would be placed in the database that the Child Care Division maintains. That could then be accessed by, that database could then be accessed by child-serving organizations. If an individual says, I've been through the voluntary background check, you can go check and see that I'm in there. that individual, the organization, could then check and see if that individual's in there. They would not have any access to LEDS. Only our staff, who are LEDS certified, have access to LEDs. Once that background check has been conducted, then that person's name goes in the voluntary background registry database that can be accessed by those individuals where, like schools and child serving agencies, to see if that person's in there or confirm that that person's in there. Does that answer your question? Or?
It does. Just one more follow-up, Madam Chair. So for those that, it sounds to me like there's kind of an outer connection then that do not have to be LEED certified that can access this, though.
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, the only individuals who can access LEEDs are those on our staff that can, you know, that have access and are certified to access those criminal background, those criminal records. Then this database, that this voluntary background registry that we're talking about, is simply a list of names, like any kind of registry, any kind of list, and has no portal, no entry to any kind of LEEDs information. It's absolute no connection.
Oh, okay. So
that's the clean box, right?
Right, that's clean box.
Yeah. There's no information about them, just three names.
Just names.
Okay, but I don't need to be LEED certified, though, to access that information.
No.
That's where I was. Okay.
Yeah.
Representative Denbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the questions that Representative Olson has asked, I think they, and your responses to them point to, the integrity of the system. We don't really have to worry, I think, about the information in it being accessed by the wrong people. Mm-hmm. I do have some concern about the way that some agencies might use it, right? If it's true that 80% of us are clean, then 20% of us are soiled somehow. And I would think in many cases not with really serious issues. And in many cases, not disqualifying issues, and I'm wondering if there's a danger of agencies, once they see that someone can't use the clean box, then, for one thing, because there might be an added expense to do a check on them, there would be discouragement of that person applying for a position, or even if it's a volunteer, or if the person being tainted in some way when an appointment decision's being made. Do you see that fear, or are there ways that we can deal with that problem?
Chair Tomei, Representative Denbrough. An individual, this is voluntary, so it is not a reflection on that individual if they're not in the voluntary, clean box. If someone is soiled or has a little something in their background that would preclude them from being in the voluntary background check, they can still go to work for the agency. They would simply go through that agency's suitability determination. So I just want to make sure that that's understood. In terms of your question about might it discourage an agency from employing or having a volunteer if they say, well, you're not in the voluntary registry, so we're not interested in you. Currently those organizations are having to do background checks, should be generally, on everyone. This would actually lower their costs if an individual is already in the voluntary background registry. So hopefully it would just limit it to those folks that would say, well, I'd rather go through your background check, or I want to, it wouldn't necessarily identify them as someone who wasn't qualified to be in the voluntary background registry. I think we're going to have to see how that plays out.
Representative Collins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I'm looking through the Dash 2 amendments, I have a question about the reasoning. On page 2, eliminations of line 20 through 27, essentially it says that should an individual be determined ineligible after their initial enrollment, then the division would simply remove that individual from the registry. But this amendment takes out the piece about notifying any agency or organization to which the individual had provided that evidence. I'm just curious about the reasoning, if anybody could help me with that.
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, the rationale there is we run quarterly name checks against the LEDS database. So if someone is enrolled in the voluntary background registry and then subsequently has a conviction, we would catch that in doing those quarterly checks, and that, again, that person's name would be removed from the registry, the voluntary background registry. The provision about notifying those agencies is primarily a fiscal issue. The division agreed, because of our ability to do these background checks and to be able to maintain this registry, but for us to maintain every potential organization that might want to use a voluntary background registry and to keep track of where individuals in the background registry might be working or volunteering, and then making that connection and locating those organizations would be a large fiscal expense for us. So we would encourage organizations that are using this to periodically check the voluntary background registry to make sure that their employees or volunteers are still enrolled.
Representative. Yeah, you.
Thank you. Just a moment. Here, time out. There we go. So, Kathleen, I guess I have it's a real simple question. For those who are not allowed to be involved in this registry,
mm-hmm.
what happens if you have an individual, a member that of the agency that was arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants, and goes through the diversion program, it's still going to be listed on his driving record, and there's a real strong possibility it could be listed also in the criminal history of CCH. So what happens with that type of individual for this program?
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, they would likely be precluded from being in the voluntary background registry. They would not necessarily be precluded from working or volunteering in an organization. I mean, for example, in the child care division in our criminal history registry for child care providers and people working in child care, that would be a matter of a suitability determination. And I can safely say we have a number of people with that kind of incident in their background who are working in child care.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Representative Booth.
That was kind of my question, too, and wondered how minor, what's the determination of minor, or do different agencies have different, to get to the suitability determination, how far do they go, like parking ticket or something, and what constitutes the criminal mm-hmm. Connotation of the infraction that would then trigger them not being able to be in the list voluntarily?
Chair Tomei,
I'm
glad you brought her along.
Oh, yeah.
I just want to make sure I understand your question. I mean, each agency has their own suitability determination. So for the voluntary background registry, likely anything above a speeding ticket, for example, would preclude you from being in the voluntary background registry. We haven't worked out the fine points. In terms of suitability determinations for each individual agency, some like an DHS who has folks that are working with senior citizens and might have access to their funds, they're going to look much more closely at financial crimes probably than Head Start is for a volunteer in their classroom. So that's where you end up with different agencies having different focuses for their suitability determinations.
Okay. Representative Van Orman, then we're going to move along.
Chair Tomei, and I think it's important to point out there's a difference between a volunteer who is supervised mm-hmm. generally and the person who is employed. And the person who is employed, there's a long list of, it's black and white. If you have a violation, and it's in that list of innumerable things that would preclude us from the job, from my experience, we were just told this person could or could not work.
In that position. Right. Okay. Any burning questions?
Actually, I do have one burning question.
All right.
Who is at the table in developing these amendments?
Madam Chair and Representative Maher, everybody we could think of that that was involved in the background process, that department, all the departments that ran criminal history checks, that we could, you know, that, and I think we had everybody there, and that was because our original mission was to see if we could get one process that all agencies that did this could agree to, and so that was the group that we asked to come together, was the folks that had the varying fitness determinations to see if there was one common one that could be used. And that's why we came up with this process, because there was not.
And follow-up. Opponents at the table?
We, Madam Chair, Representative Maher, no one was serviced as an opponent at the time that we did these meetings.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. With that, Representative Boone, would you give her a script? Lost in the pile.
There we go. Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2988, dated 9th of April, 2009.
Representative Boone moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2988, dated April 9th, 2009. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think I'm going to support the bill. I think some of the questions that were addressed here right now, I appreciate kind of addresses some concerns that we have with it, but I'm going to support the bill.
Great. Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay. Any opposition? Then the amendment is adopted. Representative Boone.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2988 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Boone moves House Bill 2988 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Okay.
Madam Chair, I just have concerns that not all the questions have been answered, and that that possibilities for other solutions have not been fully considered. Therefore, I will be a no.
Really?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right, thank you. Okay, and I would assume that maybe those questions could be addressed further on the Senate side.
Absolutely, ma'am.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Good. Okay. Zach, could you call any other discussion? Could you call the roll, please?
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
Representative Timbrough.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Mallon.
No.
Representative Van Orman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Clement.
Aye. Having received the required majority, House Bill 2988 passes. And Representative, who hasn't carried a bill lately? Representative Van Orman, since you worked in an agency that could possibly use this issue, right?
Yes.
Why don't you carry it on the floor?
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I just wondered if Representative Maurer had the crab omelet this morning.
Good question.
No. Vegetarian omelet.
You had the vegetarian.
Now we.
Maybe you should.
I could not. Yeah.
There
offend.
You go.
Crabby.
Offend our state discretion.
That explains everything.
They're volunteering.
Okay, I close the work session on House Bill 2988, and we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2051. Keely.
House Bill 2051 creates a general assistance program in the Department of Human Services to provide monthly cash assistance, medical assistance, and case management services to residents of Oregon pursuing Social Security income or Social Security disability benefits. The Dash 2 amendments redefines the terms related to the program requirements, limits the program expenditures to amounts appropriated to the Department of Human Services for the program, and allows the department to provide assistance subject to available funds.
Great. Thank you. Do we have anybody here who would like to testify on this bill? John?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I'll be very brief this morning because I know you still have a lot of work to do. Mainly, I just want to say thank you. We are supportive of the Dash 2 amendments. I want to thank Stephanie Thomas-Sweet, who worked with our coalition. I want to thank the division. I certainly want to thank Representative Freeman and Representative Dembro for being part of the work group, and thanks to the committee. And I would just mention that, you know, we have talked about this for quite a long time now, and this is, again, trying to come up with the resources to serve the poorest of the poor. We know that if this is referred out of committee down to Ways and Means, that what we have talked about with leadership and with the chair of the committee is that if we only just get the statutory changes and get a nominal amount, like a dollar, allocated to the program, we have an opportunity then, when times are better, to go ahead and open this program up and get the people that need this service into the general assistance program. So I'm very pleased about where things stand, given the circumstances we all face in the state of Oregon.
Thank you, John. And we've been dealing with this issue for many years as we've diminished the money that went into this program. And at this point, it would take a great deal of money to bring it up to where it needs to be. But this is a step, at least, to put it into statute that this is our intent over time, to put money in to support this program. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. And I want to say thank you for helping me get caught up on this and learn about this. This was the first work group I got to participate with, and I'm encouraged that not only are they looking for a way to help fund this bridge, but they're looking for ways to make the time shorter. And that really is the ultimate solution in this, is to figure out how we can more quickly get people on this disability payment and not have it be the state's problem or the state's responsibility. So thank you for allowing me to be part of it.
And Representative, thank you so much for working on that work group. I know it was difficult. And in the past, this would have passed this committee and it would have gone down to Ways and Means to die, and we would have had nothing. Mm-hmm. So at least this keeps this alive through the years, and we'll hopefully be able to put some money into it eventually. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also want to thank John for your perseverance and all the years you've worked on this, and all the work you do to help people. You are a phenomenal human being and a great citizen of Oregon. Thank you so much.
Indeed.
Very humble. Thank you.
You have the commendation of the whole committee. We'll
but he
all
owes
agree
me.
With that. Representative Dembro.
He doesn't have any money.
I know.
We're in the like Representative Freeman, this was my first work group, and it spoiled me because we didn't really have to do much, and it was a very professional group of stakeholders. Unfortunately, it caused me to volunteer for subsequent work groups where that was not necessarily the case, but it was great to get off to a good start. I do. I am really enthusiastic about the direction that this is going in.
Great. Thank you, Representative. Any further? And thanks to those of the work group. Thank you for doing that. Any further questions? All right. Who wants to make that motion? Representative Dembro, let's pass that on to him.
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2051, dated 4609.
Representative Dembro moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2051, dated April 6, 2009. Any discussion? Any objection? So adopted. And now, what's this?
We need to suspend the rules to vote on this because we don't have to vote on this right now. First aid.
Madam Chair?
I'm bleeding.
Yes.
I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 2051, without the fiscal impact statement being available for review.
Representative Dembro moves that rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 2051 without the fiscal impact statement being available for review. This motion is undebatable. So those of the opinion that the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 2051 without the fiscal impact statement being available for review will say aye, and those opposed, no. I'm just going to take a voice vote right now. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? Saying none, the motion carries and the rules have been suspended. Now.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2051 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Dembro moves House Bill 2051 as amended to the floor with that. Is that we suspend the rules?
Yes, we did, with the due pass recommendation.
With the due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any further discussion?
Yes,
Madam Chair,
Spoon.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention that this is one of those, you know, suspensions that we can imagine that whole dollar, so it's not a huge deal to worry about.
Right. Thank you. Okay. Zach, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Van Orman.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Dimbrough.
Aye.
Representative Callen.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having received the required majority, House Bill 2051 passes and will be sent to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Brian's at the wrong committee.
Okay. Thank you, Committee. Thank you, John. Thank you for everybody who was involved. Now we're going to move on to House Bill 2413.
Keely. I think you need to close the work session on 2051 and open the work session on 2413.
I will do that. So done. And open the work session on 2413.
This bill creates the Oregon Traumatic Brain Injury Strategic Partnership Advisory Council as an advisory group for the Governor and the Department of Human Services, directs DHS to provide staff support, data, and information to the council. The dash, I think we're on three now, amendment expands this to be a 19-member advisory group, requires DHS to contract with an expert to provide a preliminary report on a comprehensive statewide plan to address the needs of individuals with traumatic brain injuries, including the use of public and private collaboration, report on development of an information and referral network, statewide registry and services, and encourage and facilitate collaboration between those public and private programs. It designates a $2 fee from traffic citations to fund the program.
Who do you want to come up and tell us about this and Sherry, too?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm Tootie Smith with the Brain Injury Association. We inadvertently triggered a somewhat large fiscal in the wording of the bill. We copied Washington's bill. Of course, when you bring it down to Oregon, it's different. So we rewrote the bill, eliminating the fiscal, the huge fiscal. And we are working with the Department of Human Services at a 0.5 FTE to administer what they need to do. As far as the brain injury registry is concerned, we've changed language in here to study it and how it would be implemented, not to implement it this session, this next biennium, I mean. So we're going to study ways to do that more inexpensively. The registry basically already exists, and we just need to piggyback on top of that. But at this stage where the bill is in the session, we've run out of time to do that. So that's why we have the dash three amendments.
Okay. I'm still somewhat confused. Unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to go through the dash three.
Just fire away.
Okay. So there will still be the $2.
There will still be a $2 fiscal. However, when DHS came back, they wanted us to fund three positions, three full-time positions. It took most all of the money that we would be getting from the $2 assessment, and people with brain injuries would not be receiving any for services. So we went back and reanalyzed it and said, what can we do, basically, with the Brain Injury Association, offer those services to people and still get the money down through the levels where it needs to go. And that's the big roadblock where we ended up after the dash two amendments, is that money was not getting down to the services where they were most desperately needed.
So there will be a fiscal, we'll have to pay for a half-time position, is that true?
Yeah, just a half-time position. And Keely, that's probably minimal. And see, we're creating enough money to pay for that. To more than pay for that. We're creating about $483,000 over the biennium. A half-time position is about, $40,000, $50,000?
75.
Oh, excuse me, 75 by the time he had benefits and so forth.
Yeah.
Madam Chair.
I just want to make sure, was there anything, so this will have to go to Ways and Means, it'll have to go to Revenue.
Revenue.
Okay, Representative
I just didn't hear her quite. Could you repeat the amount of revenue that you...
$483,000.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry. The revenue, that's what the revenue estimates are.
So would the rest of the money then, Tootie, that doesn't pay for that, for the FTE...
Mm-hmm. It will go...
Would the rest of it go to your registry?
No, actually, none will go to the registry this biennium. They're just going to submit a report on how more easily to do that for us. What it's going to do is go to support programs and groups, and Sherry can talk on that
okay.
more.
Sherry, would you do that? Unless we've got... Well, let's hear what Sherry has to say and see if there are more questions.
My name is Sherry Stock, Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association. Basically, what we did with the amendments is... rather than DHS providing the services, they would be contracted out to someone in the state that is an expert in brain injury services and already provides these services statewide. So the services already exist. It is just supporting these services and getting more services out to more people. And a half-time position would be funded in DHS to support the council. And the council then would oversee any money that would come in to the trust fund from the traffic tickets that is not taken up in DHS reimbursements would then go to services that the council would, as a group, decide on which way they want to go.
Is the council in effect right now?
No. The council was created with the Governor's Task Force on Traumatic Brain Injury in 2001 through 2002. So a lot of those people would still be on board. They haven't retired yet, so they would be part of this council. What we tried to do with the council is have a representative or the director from every division. So brain injury crosses all demographics and crosses all disabilities. So we tried to pull every department together, whether it's seniors and people with disabilities, mental health, veterans, or returning veterans are coming back, huge percentage with brain injury. So it's getting the services to everyone that needs them, and the education, and helping develop new services is what we're intending to do with this.
Sherry, I think you've been coming in front of this committee for many years trying to get something. So is this the first step to get to where you want to be?
It's a beginning. It is. Mm-hmm. And with this, with money coming in this kind of thing, we can create an awareness program so people are more aware of what a brain injury is. We can get some support services going to get people back to work. Everybody wants to return to work. You are, in this country, you are what your job is. And so people with brain injury are having a problem staying employed because they have some different disabilities. And so this would help create programs that could support them so they'd be back into the workforce and out of social services and actually bringing tax money in, helping veterans come back, and also being able to leverage funds to gather more federal funds because we can get a 2-to-1 match if the money is there, but we need to have the money coming in to get that 2-to-1 match.
If I can add more, on page 5 of the amendments, line C, we changed the registry to say provide a report on the development of the statewide registry, how they want to set it up, how much it will cost. They just kind of threw something at us, and I don't think it was quite adequate the way we wanted to go. So during the interim, we want to take some time to adequately develop it.
And I think we would like that report to come to us, and we'll have
Oh, absolutely. You can have everything. Absolutely everything, and you've just been wonderful to work at. Something else. Many times, I know you hear a lot of mental health issues in this committee. Many times, brain injury is misdiagnosed as mental health, and those mental health treatments and avenues many times don't work on brain injury because obviously it's misdiagnosed. So hopefully this will help alleviate some of that that's happening in those systems.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an issue that's very important to the Veterans Committee and the task force that worked on veterans issues during the past interim. It's one that we sort of took off the table in my Veterans Committee because we knew that it was being worked in this one. So I want to, first of all, express my appreciation for the representation on the group from the veterans community, and I guess ask that we coordinate some of these reports back. Maybe we could even have a joint, make it easier with a joint hearing, but I would ask that you help keep the Interim Veterans Committee work
In the loop. That would certainly be our intent. You know, I think with the veterans issue, it really shed light on our issue in general. And, of course, when this program set up, we wouldn't discriminate against any group that had a brain injury, so all people would be inclusive in this.
Thank you. Just follow-up. Brief follow-up. I appreciate that. I don't want to in any way suggest that, that we thought that there was any being left out, but I want to put on the record that the Veterans Committee is also equally interested in the progress and would like to be as helpful as we can.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tudy and Sherry, please don't take this wrong, okay? And I appreciate all the work that you're doing. I've been struggling with this since the public hearing because I hate getting the state involved in stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm just wondering, why do we need to involve the state? I mean, I've heard little bits of it. I guess maybe several questions. Why the governor's work group at the end of 2002 disbanded? Because it is a critical thing that you're trying to work toward bringing, shedding a light on and getting solutions. I wonder why the work group didn't continue on their own, and why your association can't accomplish this without getting the government involved.
I can answer the first part of that, and then she can answer the second part. Money has literally dried up with the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. We depended on private donations and the grants. And Sherry applied for a grant a couple months ago, and I think there was 5,000 applicants for $10,000 worth of money or some. I mean, it's hugely competitive right now. Most states have programs for brain injury people. Oregon is very much lagging behind what the national norm is. This program is copied from Washington and other states who have been very successful in doing that. We, as a private organization, cannot take on the whole medical field when it comes to brain injury. It's one of the reasons why the board is created, to give credibility to what we're doing. We cannot exist as a private 501c3 and think we're going to solve the world with brain injuries. So we need to incorporate that. And the people in the DHS have lots and lots of expertise with their epidemiologists and their doctors to guide us in the treatment and administration of brain injuries. That's why there's the government involvement. And then Sherry can answer the rest.
On the task force still does meet periodically. And actually, we've gotten a couple federal grants through Teaching Research, the Department of Education, and that has been bringing the task force together periodically. It's really just a volunteer, but they're incredible because this is a major issue for everyone that's concerned. So people do come together. And the Brain Injury Association is a part of the reintegration team, so we go to all the summits and work with the spouses of returning veterans and the veterans themselves, trying to help them find programs and access into community resources, which there's quite a few community resources around Portland. The rest of the state has almost nothing. You know, I get calls from Coos Bay and the Dalles and Pendleton and LeGrand, and people are desperate for services, and there are no services to refer them to.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
One of my main concerns, it probably isn't as much the $2 addition to the fine as it is in education. Department of Education has been willing to donate staff time to staff a couple of task forces, and has the department, DHS, been asked if they would supply this half FTE? $75,000 in payroll and benefits, you know, when we do have a traumatic need like this, I just wondered if the department has been asked if they would staff it.
I think maybe 2 years ago they might have done that. You know, we're in a 30% reduction across the board, and I don't think the resources are there to staff it if they could.
Talk about where it's going to.
Yeah, one of the things that we're hoping is that the staffing would come from the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation. And because we have a very strong relationship, working relationship with them, and there are national grants that if with this money coming in, a half-time person coming into the Department of Voc Rehab, they could use that for a 2-to-1 federal match, which would bring in even, you know, obviously double that in from the feds into their program. And like, as I said earlier, the biggest thing for us is helping people that don't have resources, but also getting them back into work, because everybody wants to work, and or the majority. And so it's Voc Rehab is working very, very closely with the Brain Injury Association and people with brain injury to get them back to being employed.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. You had a question?
No, I'm done. I'm done.
You're done.
You.
Okay, mm-hmm. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Tomahan. Thank you guys for the work you do. What an important need, and I understand the challenges around the funding of it. and unlike Representative Huffman, my issue is exclusively the $2 fee. So my questions are around, with as large a budget as DHS has and with what we're doing for our veterans that are out there, it seems to me like this $500,000 you're trying to generate should be out there somewhere already. And the idea that we need to start having more fees and more taxes for people to start new programs that are as important as yours makes no sense to me. You know, we talked about some of the other departments' willingness to participate in viable and good projects. What's better than your project? I mean, I can't even imagine why this doesn't already exist. And with the exception of the $2 fee, I would be all over supporting this. So just so you know where I'm coming from on that.
Madam Chair, quickly answer that. Senator Morissette has been working on this issue, I think, as long as he has been in the legislature and has gotten nowhere. And he's probably more dedicated to this than anything. The reason for this, the $2 traffic fee on moving violations, because our research shows that brain injuries, the largest percentage of brain injuries comes from traffic accidents. So therefore, the people who are disobeying a law, speeding, running a traffic light, they pay an additional $2, and it is voluntary, by the way, voluntary in that the judge can impose that at court. So we feel the people who have the potential to cause this type of injury pay. It's not across the board. It's not a fee increase. It's not a tax. It's a unitary assessment. So that's really important to understand.
Representative Van Orman.
Madam Chair, I would just like to say that if Oregon State is having difficulty raising money for sports this year, I think it's indicative of what's out there in the community when it comes to fundraising. I think it's a huge challenge.
Dan, it's for you.
Oh, thank you. It's a huge challenge for raising money, and it's a very difficult time. Everybody's hurting.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Yes, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was way back going to speak to the $2 fee, and here it comes again. This, and you're right, it's been happening for a long time, trying to get this through. Dedicated funding is the only way people are going to get stuff at this point. And having attended many, many traffic crashes and wanting somehow to, knowing that some of these people may not ever pay, so to speak, for anything. A $2 fee for someone who causes a traumatic brain injury, which affect someone's life for the rest of their life. And I'm here to tell you, I don't know how they do it, but it usually ends up it's the person's whose fault it is. They're impaired by some substance. They could give a rip. They can see what damage they've done. They don't care. They are so disconnected from that. And to have this tiny little piece that they might have to pay when they go through their trial to go to try to compensate in some manner. And I wanted to speak earlier to the money issue. And most of the money, I think we want to go to the research and treatment. We want it to go to the services that are the research projects that are out there having trouble attracting grant money too, so that separate the money out so it's not in competition, and let the advocacy group do outreach, education, et cetera, and let people know what an issue it is. We can't put a fee on the IEDs that are going off in Iraq and Afghanistan. We can't put a fee on Al-Qaeda and all the damage they're doing to our troops when they're over there. But that's just one part of it. There's all kinds of traumatic brain, sports injuries, kids falling off their bike and hitting, I mean, just the falling the right way and hitting their head. And plus, a seizure disorder that's caused by these injuries. This is a very small thing that these people can do. I mean, if I get a traffic violation, I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to, in addition to the fine I might get, to pay $2 to go to something like this. This is a great thing. So I think I'm going to be a yes.
I wanted to know. Thank you.
Just a side note, Madam Chair, side note on the funding. these are not federal funds. They're not general funds. They're considered other funds.
Right.
For your...
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Which is a good thing.
Representative Olson, did you have anything to
Definitely.
Say? Are we ready for a vote?
Well, in fact, I do, Madam Chair. Thank you. Now, I really do greatly appreciate what both of you have done with this, and I have been very torn with this wanting to support this. But at this point right now, with the $2 assessment and the information and the folks that I'm receiving emails from and phone calls from in my area, they're struggling something fierce. Don't tag on any additional fees to traffic violations this year. And I don't think they were specifically talking about this issue. They just didn't want to have any more increases to any minimum mandatory fines. So, I mean, with that having been said, I truly appreciate where you're wanting to go with this. I understand that, and I am torn with this, but with that having been said, Madam Chair, I'm going to be a no.
Okay. Great. Representative Olson, thank you. I mean, Representative Boone, you're the other one.
That would be me, the other Representative Olson. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -3 amendments to House Bill 2413, dated 20th of April, 2009, my son's birthday.
Congratulations. Representative Boone moves to adopt the -3 amendments to House Bill 2413, dated April 20th, 2009. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, the amendments are adopted. Representative Boone.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 2413 without the fiscal impact statement being available for review.
Do I have that?
Yes, ma'am. Probably right behind it.
Okay. Representative Boone moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 2413 without the fiscal impact statement being available for review. This motion is undebatable. Those of the opinion that the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 2413 without the fiscal impact statement being available for review will say aye, and those opposed, no. And I'll just take a voice vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Seeing none, motion carries, and rules have been suspended. Now, Representative Boone.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2413 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Representative moves that House Bill 2413 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Van Orman.
Aye.
Representative Mallon.
No.
Representative Huffman.
Excused.
Representative Freeman.
No.
Representative Denbrough.
Aye.
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. Having received the required majority, House Bill 2413 as amended is passed, and it will, so it goes to the floor first, or the revenue?
Committee on Revenue.
Committee on Revenue. And then it will come to the floor, right?
Yes.
And Representative Boone, would you carry this on the floor?
I'd be delighted.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2413.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, ladies, for your hard work on this. Okay, so now we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 3114.
House Bill 3114 requires the Department of Human Services to develop rules for prescription and monitoring of psychotropic drugs taken by children in foster care. It mandates assessment by qualified mental health professionals, annual review of medications, and appropriate indicators for determining that psychotropic medications should be surprised. Prescribed. Not surprised. We previously adopted the Dash 3 amendments, which changes the standards for a required prescription review. And I guess that's all. I don't see Representative Kotek or anyone.
Madam Chair, I was involved in the work group.
Great. You want to talk with us about it, please?
Yeah. Madam Chair, there was a work group convened, and it was led by Representative Kotek's staff, who did a fabulous job of managing that process. We had a number of people at the table and who had concerns about the original language of the bill, the Dash 3 amendments. I say satisfied the members of the group because there was a clear consensus that we need to do something, and that this originated from an Oregonian article,
right,
like many things that we do here, unfortunately. But it brought to light that there's not much review or oversight of the administration of psychotropic drugs for children in foster care, and that this was a backstop for that process. And so I am very supportive of the bill. And in fact, do we have a fiscal?
We don't have a fiscal impact. We'll be adding a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
So we'll have to
suspend the rules. And Madam Chair, I quite frankly don't know what the fiscal will be. It may be, I think it's going to be relatively small, but the state has to do something with this. And so there is now a backstop to at least monitor these children.
Great. Thank you, Representative. Thank you for working on that. And I know that Representative Kotek's staff is in here. I hope they're listening on their monitor, and we want to thank them, too. So any further discussion on this?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I have a question. I'm not sure if it's a question or if it's an observation, that the expense that I might see would be the mental health professional that they might engage, but then these children should be covered by the health plan.
Correct, but there's a review process annually that has to take place.
Okay.
And that's where the additional cost may come in.
Okay. Thank you.
I would just point out that Representative Kotek is co-chair of the Ways and Means Sub on Human Services, so I would imagine this will get a very positive hearing.
Well, and like I said, I honestly don't know what the fiscal is going to show.
Yeah, but I agree with Representative Maurer. Needs to be done.
Okay. Any further questions, Representative?
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 3114 without the fiscal impact statement being available for review.
Representative Olson moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 3114 without the fiscal impact being available for review. Don't we need to accept the amendment first?
We did that at a previous meeting.
Oh, thank you. Okay. This motion is undebatable. So those of the opinion that the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 3014 without the fiscal impact statement being available for review, we'll say aye and oppose no, and I'll just take an oral vote. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none, the motion carries and the rules have been suspended.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3114 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 3114 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Talon.
Aye.
Representative Dembrough.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Excused.
Representative Mauer.
Aye.
Representative Van Orman.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having received the required majority, House Bill 3114, as amended, passes and goes to the Committee on Ways and Means. And then, Representative Mauer, would you carry it on the floor?
Madam Chair, actually, I think Representative Kotek, mm-hmm. That was her
you're
bill.
You're right. Representative Kotek will carry it on the floor. Thank you, Representative. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 3114.
I'm sorry, before you close completely, will you please reiterate the ones we carried over just so that
we're carrying over House Bill 2726, House Bill 2990, House Bill 2207, House Bill 3384, and House Bill 2134.
And House Bill 3065. Yeah, it didn't get on there. That's a good thing I had that.
3065. Okay.
Then we're done on
so, yes. So talk with us a little bit. So hopefully, colleagues will be hearing those bills that I just mentioned on Monday and hopefully passing them out of committee. Do you have any questions about our process? And then we'll start hearing Senate bills and hopefully passing those. And then we will have time to have hearings on other issues, such as Representative Hannah's bill. I hope we'll spend more time on that in the future. No?
No, Madam Chair, we will evaluate the Senate bills and address them on their own merits.
That's a good point.
Of course.
Thank you for that.
Can I just say, I don't know, and I haven't had an opportunity to talk with Representatives Mauer and Dembrough. We received the amendments back on the carbon monoxide bill yesterday, and those were not what we requested. So we're going to request that we be able to send that to rules.
So that it can be carried forward. Yeah.
That's fine. Mm-hmm. I mean,
Madam
Chair, quite frank, you know, it appears simple on the face of it, but it gets complex and deep, and there's someone's writing a big check someplace to do this. Mm-hmm.
But I think we did find a way to resolve this problem. So there are drafting problems. Is that what you're saying, Keith?
Yeah.
Part of what we did was remove the state fire marshal from enforcement, and that wasn't done in the amendment. So that's where the huge fiscal impact was going to occur, and so we're going to have to readdress that.
Great.
Okay, good. Thanks for your work on that. I really appreciate it. It's an important bill. Anything else for the good of the order? If not, we'll close the House Committee on Human Services.